This week, we reach the end of an era as Elisha, junior member of the Elijah-Elisha prophetic duo, exits the narrative. The passage is 2 Kings 13, 18 chapters after Elijah first appeared in 1 Kings 17. This passage then represents the wrapping up of a long-running story arc in which the prophets appeared to denounce the sins of Israel and particularly of the house of Ahab. Israel's judgment for this was a bitter pill to swallow. The house of Jehu toppled Ahab's dynasty within Israel, while Hazael, the ruthless king of Aram, burned a path of destruction across both kingdoms. In today's passage, two new kings arise from the house of Jehu. The wrath of Hazael is finally abated, and the prophet is laid to rest. Your passage for consideration is 2 Kings 13, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. For the last couple of weeks, we've been considering events in Judah, where Jehu had killed their king, leaving Athaliah, queen from the dread house of Ahab, to seize the throne until she was deposed by the high priest Jehoiada. That effectively ended the influence of Ahab there. So this week, we turn back to the northern kingdom of Israel, where Jehu had overthrown and slaughtered Ahab's dynasty. This, in some sense, was an overkill, and Jehu still didn't turn the people away from idolatry. Meanwhile, Hazael had conquered all of the land east of the Jordan and turned his sights on Judah's territory. Jehovah, likely through a prophet, told Jehu that four generations of kings would rule from his line. Today we will breeze through two of them, Jehu's son Jehoahaz and his son Jehoash. Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, is not to be confused with Joash, boy king of Judah, whom we discussed last week. Jehoash and Joash are alternate spellings of the same thing, and in the original language, the passages frustratingly use both names in describing each of the two kings. For clarity's sake, I have consistently used Joash to describe the boy king of Judah, and will use Jehoash to describe the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We need to discuss the father before the son. Before Jehoash came Jehu's Jehoahaz. He took the throne in the 23rd year of Ahaziah, approximately the 120th year after the split between the two kingdoms. His reign would last a relatively short 17 years. The length of his reign probably was not helped by the fact that he did evil as all the kings of Israel before him, following the idolatrous ways of Jeroboam son of Nebat. The result was continued conquest and oppression by Hazael. Today's passage also mentions, for the first time, Hazael's son Ben-Hadad. That would be Ben-Hadad III, since, as you will recall, Hazael had killed his predecessor Ben-Hadad II. It might seem strange for a usurper to name his son after the king he had killed, but my supposition is that once he seized the throne, he likely took one of Ben-Hadad II's daughters as a wife. Doing this and then naming the heir for the former king might help lend some credibility to his dynasty. Crushed under Hazael's weight, Jehoahaz cried out to Jehovah for help, but did not fully devote himself to him. The people still followed Jeroboam's idols and maintained a shrine to Asherah. Regardless, Jehovah intervened. He is a God of justice, and when he sees oppression, even the oppression of the wicked, he is of a mind to intervene. God raised up a deliverer, some unnamed military hero, who drove out the Arameans. My supposition is that this intends that they were driven back across the Jordan, but not out of Gilead, east of the Jordan, but the passage is not very specific. All of this fighting came at a staggering military cost. In the end, Israel had only 10,000 soldiers, 50 horsemen, and 10 chariots. With numbers that small, it is a wonder Hazael was not able to send a fresh wave of soldiers to topple them completely. A faint breeze, I would think, could have done Israel in. It is not unheard of for us to see military forces in the hundreds of thousands at this time. See, for example, Rehoboam's army of 180,000 in 1 Kings 12:21, 120 years prior, or Asa's 580,000 in 2 Chronicles 14:8. Roughly 80 years prior. So we're talking about armies reduced in size by 95%. Where Jehoahaz had only 10 chariots remaining, Ahab had brought 32 commanders of entire chariot fleets into battle at Ramoth-Gilead only 50 years prior. See 1 Kings 22:31. And he lost that battle against Aram. So these past few decades of war with Aram and internal strife had clearly decimated the fighting population. That's all for Jehoahaz. Our author cites his source, the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, not to be confused with the biblical Book of Chronicles, and Jehoahaz died, and we move on to his son Jehoash. Apart from his interaction with Elisha, today's passage says very little about Jehoash's reign, just a handful of verses, and most of those are the standard this many years, this source, this burial. But we should be careful to note that we have more information about him in 2 Chronicles 25 and 2 Kings 14, where Jehoash is described as fighting a successful war against Judah. We'll look at that war next week when we consider these chapters and Amaziah's reign in Judah. For now, let's get the basics before we move on to Elisha. Jehoash became king in the 37th year of Joash in Judah. This was approximately 137 years after the split. He reigned 16 years to about 153 post-split. He continued in the sins of Jeroboam and died. His record recorded in the Chronicles, his son took the throne, etc. More interesting in his reign is that Elisha died, but not before making a final prophecy about how Jehoash would beat back Hazael and the Arameans, bringing to a close that long-running story arc. Elisha was ill and lay dying. Jehoash was not a devout follower of Jehovah, but by this point in the narrative, Elisha had risen to a pinnacle of respect as a leader of the nation. He had been a prophet in Israel for at least 59 years, during which time he had performed miracles as amazing as raising the dead, had delivered prophecies which guided the nation, including rescuing them in times of war, and he and his followers had anointed the kings of multiple kingdoms, including Jehu, Jehoash's grandfather. In some sense, Jehoash owed him the kingdom. And so Jehoash fell down before him and wept, saying, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen." This, of course, harkens back to 2 Kings 2:12, where Elisha cried out the same words when his predecessor Elijah ascended in the whirlwind. The words intend, apparently, that Elisha was a man of critical importance to the nation, as important as the horses and chariots were to the army which defended them. They also suggest to us, whether or not this was Jehoash's intent, that Elisha had fulfilled Elijah's calling, living out the worth of the double portion that he had inherited. Elisha is not some mere sidekick to Elijah. He is a great prophet in his own right, and he had a final prophecy here to deliver before his death, this one with some hands-on symbolic imagery to accompany it. First, Elisha directed Jehoash to shoot an arrow out the east window in the direction of a ram. This was a symbol to the king that he would defeat the Arameans, finally eliminating the threat from Hazael. By obeying Elisha's somewhat strange instruction to shoot an arrow out the window, the king had performed a small act of faith, and for that he would be rewarded. But for the second act of prophecy, the king performed with some hesitation. He faltered. Perhaps he was confused or embarrassed. He acted with a little less confidence. Elisha told him to strike the ground with his bundle of arrows. Jehoash did so, but not with much vigor. He struck the ground only three times. Well, when the prophet of God tells you to do something, you ought not to waver about doing it. Since Jehoash had struck only three times, he would win only three decisive battles to drive a ram out. Had he gone about this strange task wholeheartedly, he might have continued in pursuit until he had destroyed a ram completely. And I must say, Jehoash really must have done some work building up his military, because he did win three decisive victories over a ram, and not only that, but, as we will consider next week, he won victories over Judah as well. It is a stunning comeback from the nation that had only 10,000 soldiers less than 20 years prior. These victories came after Hazael's death and recaptured all of those cities which had been taken in the days of Jehoahaz. As for Elisha, he died and was placed in a tomb, location unmentioned. There were no chariots of fire to take him away in a whirlwind like Elijah, but even in death, Elisha had one last miracle up his sleeve, recorded in verses 20 and 21. Not long after Elisha's death, some men were preparing to bury a dead man when a band of Moabite raiders appeared. They threw the corpse into Elisha's tomb, and when the man's body touched Elisha's, he was restored to life. Unfortunately, we get no other details. And so after he figured prominently in some 8 to 10 sermons, we bid farewell to Elisha. He first appeared in 1 Kings 19 when God sent Elijah to appoint him as his successor. Elisha demonstrated himself to be a man of great faith when he followed Elijah, who at this time was a wanted criminal for his ministry. In 2 Kings 2, Elisha showed a determination to follow Elijah to the very end, and as a reward he received the ministry. Elisha performed a number of miracles in 2 Kings 2 through 8, showing himself to be Elijah's equal and also prefiguring the work of Christ, the greatest of all prophets. Under Elisha's leadership, the company of the prophets grew, and the long-awaited purge of Israel finally came when Elisha and his followers appointed Hazael king of Aram and Jehu king over Israel. In this, the work of defeating the prophets of Baal, which Elijah had started, came to fruition. And then in today's passage, Hazael finally met his end as well. In all, Elisha served for at least 59 and maybe as many as 90 years, his tenure as prophet overlapping 6 kings of Israel. And so we bid him farewell. In application, let us give more consideration to Elisha's prophecy concerning the arrows. From the outset, we should remember one thing plainly. God has had a predestined plan from the beginning of the universe. We see this throughout the Bible. See, for example, Romans 9, Ephesians 1, etc. Our fates and the fate of our nation and world are not predicated on something silly like how many times one strikes the ground with an arrow. Indeed, the swinging of the arrows is itself part of the predetermined plan. It has always been the case that Joash was to swing the arrows 3 times and that he would win 3 victories. God's plans are not so easily thwarted, and yet we are active participants in the playing out of the plan. Our choices are all known and foreordained ahead of time, but we still choose them, and we are still accountable for our choices. Jehoash never would have chosen to strike more vigorously, but he theoretically could have, and so he is accountable for his choice. We too are accountable for our choices. We make our choices and our actions, which flow from them in response to our beliefs. The old prophet told Jehoash to shoot an arrow out the window. Jehoash could have chosen not to do so. He was a king, and the old man was dying. He could not force Jehoash's hand. So why did Jehoash shoot? Why was he there to begin with? Clearly he was a man of at least some faith. He believed that there was something to this old man in the tales of his prophecies and miracles. That small faith resulted in action, and that action brought about God's plan. But from where did Jehoash get this small grain of faith? Did he conjure it up on his own? No, our faith is also part of God's predetermined plan. Ephesians 2:8 tells us, "By grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God." So God gives us faith as a gift. Paul continues in verse 11 saying, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." So God has a plan. He plans to give some people faith, and then that faith results in works according to the plan. It was always God's plan to defeat Hazael and the Arameans through Jehoash. And so he gave Jehoash the small faith to shoot an arrow. Seeing that arrow fly and hearing the prophet's encouragement strengthened Jehoash's faith so that he would go out and accomplish that work which had been prepared for him. But God had also prepared for Jehoash to win not too many battles. Jehoash was not a great man of faith. After all, he followed the sins of Jeroboam. He was a half-hearted man who would win half of the victories, and this was reflected in striking with the arrows. The prophet told him to strike the ground, and the king's half-faith led him to half-respond. Lackluster whacking foretold of lackluster victories, and so Jehoash won three times and no more. I have to wonder, though, about the self-fulfilling nature of that prophecy. If a great prophet tells you that you will win three battles, will you stop fighting after the second? And if he tells you three and no more, will you tempt fate by going out to fight a fourth? Regardless, the point is that God has a plan to give his people faith that drives them to good works. It is my prayer, then, and my encouragement for you that you will grow in your faith, and that you will take to heart James's words in chapter 2, verses 17 through 18 of his epistle. Faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. I will show you my faith by my works. I urge you, don't be half-hearted in your works. Don't swing the arrows only three times. Whatever you do, do it with all your heart, as Colossians 3:23 reminds us. Show your faith to be strong by your strong works and accomplish the plan of God. And finally, let's not neglect the Christological implications of this surprising resurrection from the dead. We have mentioned before how both Elijah and Elisha pointed forward to Christ's work by their miracles, especially in that both of them raised the dead. See 1 Kings 17 and 2 Kings 4. But here Elisha takes it a step further, raising the dead from within his tomb while he himself was dead. Now Elisha is not Jesus. He didn't take this all the way by raising himself from the dead. But seeing the dead man walk out of the prophet's tomb was about the closest one could get to prefiguring the real thing. So Elisha points the way to Christ, and Christ fulfills and supersedes the greatest expectations. To conclude then, 2 Kings 13 tells us briefly about the reigns of two descendants of Jehu over Israel, Jehoahaz and Jehoash. Both of these struggled against the Aramean threat. As Elisha lay dying, he gave a final prophecy to Jehoash that he would defeat Aram three times, driving them out but not destroying them. Jehoash's victories were aligned with God's foreordination and were proportional to his faith. Jehoash's lackluster response to the prophet's command to swing the arrows reminds us to respond fully to God by showing our strong faith and our strong works. And of course, we bid farewell to Elisha, that great prophet who once again has given us a foreshadowing of Christ's resurrection. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.